I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Is impeachment just a silly partisan idea or necessary to curb the increasing power of the presidency? We're going to take a closer look. But first, there's been news in Zimbabwe. Opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has reportedly sought refuge in the Dutch embassy in Zimbabwe, and police raided his party's headquarters this morning. Yesterday, Tsvangirai withdrew from the runoff presidential election scheduled for this Friday, saying it was no longer credible and that the loss of life among his supporters was simply too high. That announcement cleared the way for President Robert Mugabe to continue his 28-year reign, although Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice said today that Zimbabwe's government would not be legitimate without fair elections. Well, joining us from South Africa, Scott Baldoff of the Christian Science Monitor. And Scott, do we know, first of all, why Tsvangirai is at the Dutch embassy?
Mr. Tsvangirai, of course, has been he's been singled out for harassment by the ruling party, by police. He's been arrested some five times in a very few number of days. His own secretary general has been brought up on charges of treason, merely for suggesting that there could be a transfer of power after the MDC won an election. So it is a time that is obviously one of great concern for Mr. Tsvangirai. I think he is largely doing this for his own safety and security.
Well, tell us more about the so-called former war veterans who make up Mugabe's support. They, we know, seized the white-owned farms by force back in 2000. Mugabe was seen as a freedom fighter, and they now today are leading some of the attacks on the opposition. You told us at one point that these so-called war veterans weren't likely to give up power or those farms. Is that fueling their continued fight against the opposition?
Well, I think at this stage, there is an element of every man for himself. There's concern, I think, on part of many of the people who have carried out the government's will, or rather President Mugabe's will, by using violence. And the militias known as the war veterans, many of them, by the way, young enough that they could not possibly have served in the War of Liberation back in 1980, they would be very concerned about whether they would face charges, human rights charges, and possibly even to be sent to The Hague for rights violations such as the violence we're seeing today.
With the opposition leader bowing out, taking refuge in the Dutch embassy, what is the likelihood that the government will go ahead with the runoff election on Friday if there's only one candidate running?
Well, at this stage, what the government is saying is that they have only heard about Mr. Tsvangirai's pulling out of the election by reading it in the newspapers. They say they have not received a formal letter, and until they receive that formal letter, they will continue to hold the election. Now, there will be probably a mass boycott by supporters of the opposition group. So the question then becomes, will this election have any legitimacy with the people of Zimbabwe and the larger region?
Meanwhile, as you write, many in the international community have been silent, have been quiet about Zimbabwe. Neighboring countries refusing to sanction Zimbabwe over the harassment of the opposition. Do you think there will be more response from the region?
Well, there is a split among Zimbabwe's neighbors. South Africa and other countries such as Angola and Mozambique have been calling for patience. Let's give the possible mediation being done by President Mbeki here in South Africa, let's give that a chance. Other nations, many of whom bear the brunt of the immigrants coming out of Zimbabwe. Remember, Zimbabwe has a staggering 1,000,000% inflation rate, 80% unemployment. Many people just simply cannot earn a living there and are fleeing for economic reasons as well as political ones. So Zambia, for instance, their leader called the election a scandal. The leader of Botswana also received a lot of Zimbabwean refugees. And he has been strongly against Mugabe's reign and calling for stronger action. So we're seeing a split, and that may add more pressure on particularly South Africa's president, Mr. Mbeki, to get a little more vigorous when it comes to his negotiations with Mr. Mugabe.
The Christian Science Monitor, Scott Baldoff from South Africa, on today's news that the opposition leader in Zimbabwe has taken refuge in the Dutch embassy there. Scott, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
to our conversation today. Should President George W. Bush be impeached? This month, Congressman Dennis Kucinich filed 35 articles of impeachment against Bush, accusing him of crimes ranging from misleading the American public about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction to mismanaging Hurricane Katrina. But as with Kucinich's attempts to impeach Vice President Cheney last year, this one went nowhere in Congress. The House, by a vote of 251-166, sent the charges to committee, and the issue will likely die there. Why isn't impeachment taken more seriously? A majority of the public thinks the war in Iraq was a mistake, and more is becoming known about how the Bush administration managed that war. So why is the impeachment issue being tabled? Is there no legal case for impeachment, or is it simply a matter of will and timing? Let's start with David Barron, professor of law at Harvard Law School. David, remind us, what under the Constitution is an impeachable offense?
Well, the constitutional phrase is high crimes and misdemeanors. The thing we know most about it is that the framers decided to have something somewhat narrower than maladministration or just poor performance in office. But what the actual phrase high crimes and misdemeanors means is something that's been debated for a long time. Some people think it has a very clear definition legally, dating all the way back to English practice. Others have suggested it's really a political term. Gerald Ford famously said an impeachable offense is whatever the House of Representatives says it is.
And how is impeachment, this trial of a president, done?
Well, it's first voted on by the House as a whole, and if the House decides to impeach, it then goes to the Senate for essentially a trial to determine whether to convict.
And if they vote to convict, they can remove the president from office.
Correct.
Well, in the past month alone, we've had a slew of damaging revelations about Bush administration policies. The Senate Intelligence Committee reported that there was no intelligence to back up President Bush's contention that Saddam Hussein was working with al-Qaeda. That committee also found that the administration ignored doubts about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. The Senate Armed Services Committee took testimony that top administration officials sought out information from the military about harsh interrogation techniques that could be used against terrorism suspects. Physicians for Human Rights produced physical evidence that some detainees were tortured. We've had the Supreme Court for a third time strike down policies that limit the legal rights of Guantanamo Bay detainees. Now, we're going to be talking to former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman. She says the Senate intelligence report alone made it official that the president deceived the public and Congress to go to war. She says that's an impeachable offense. Your thoughts from a legal standpoint?
Well, I think the one helpful way to think about it is just put it in context. Presidential impeachment obviously is a very rare occurrence. There's really only been three significant impeachment episodes with the president in the history of the country. The first with Andrew Johnson at the end of the middle of Reconstruction. The second with President Nixon, which I think, even though it never came to a conviction, he resigned, is thought of as the closest we've had to a truly successful impeachment process. And then President Clinton, who was impeached by the House, acquitted in the Senate. And if you look at that range of practices, I think one thing you get is it's a very rare thing to do. We've had many unpopular presidents. We've had many presidents who have done very bad things, but we haven't impeached any of them. So I think the bar in that practical sense is extremely high. The second thing I think that's noteworthy, particularly about the Iraq War, is during the Nixon impeachment process, there were articles of impeachment put forward on Nixon with respect to the secret bombing of Cambodia and the thought that he had deceived the public, lied about a war, which is similar to the charge now being made against the president. That was the one article of impeachment that failed. And some think of that as a bit of a precedent about the worry that people have about using the impeachment process as a means of fighting out quite serious foreign policy disputes and challenges about the conduct of the president with respect to foreign policy.
Well, the specific war-related charge that Kucinich is bringing is that the president created a secret propaganda campaign to manufacture a false case for war against Iraq, citing many sources saying that the war was sold like a new product by the administration and that the president abused the trust of the American people. Elizabeth Holtzman asks, doesn't the Constitution require us to do something? If the Congress is installed by the Constitution as a check and balance, and if Congress was misled, doesn't that subvert the intent of the Constitution?
Well, there's no doubt the charge, if proven in full, is as serious as you could be if it was a true propaganda tool, and particularly if it was for political purposes. And there'd be no question, at least in my mind, that that's the kind of thing that could be an impeachable offense. But the Constitution has many different mechanisms for checking a president and registering disapproval of him. So I think it's a mistake to view impeachment as the only mechanism we have for registering disapproval, strong disapproval, even condemnation of a policy the president's initiated that's troubling and seems antithetical to the basic premises of a democracy.
You've said what others have said, that there's sort of a whiff of implications of allegations of, but even Kucinich doesn't say the president lied. Neither did the Senate Intelligence Committee in its report, nor does former Bush spokesperson Scott McClellan in his tell-all book. Does the word lie have to be used? Is that part of the problem for you?
I think it's related to it. I put it in another way in the Nixon impeachment. Not only were there quite serious preparatory hearings by Senator Ervin well before we even went into impeachment proceedings, but there was also an ongoing criminal process and a special prosecutor who was alleging actual criminal conduct and could pursue in sort of a criminal prosecutorial mode this question of lying, motive, all that type of thing, which is much more difficult absent that mechanism being in place. And I think some of what's going on here is the processes of oversight to some extent had broken down over the course of the last 6 years, and they're being restored. But I think that means the clock to get the investigation going, if you wanted to move to a more serious consideration of impeachment, it's just running out. And I think the difficulty, and I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing for the House and the Senate to consider, is if we're going to have a new president, how much should the election of that new president be tied up with a nasty fight about what should happen to this president now in the course of impeachment? It seems to me that for the people who are very concerned about what the Bush administration has done, it would be quite a shame to make the new election anyway a referendum on whether this president should be impeached.
Which, of course, is infuriating to Bush detractors who say that it shouldn't be a matter of convenience whether or not, you know, he is impeached. And even, the Senate committee chair, Senator Rockefeller, wrote that the U.S. was led to war based on false pretenses. And they would say, his detractors, isn't that lying? Bill Clinton said it depends on the definition of is. You know, so isn't it just splitting hairs to say Bush hasn't lied? And if he has, it goes back to Elizabeth Holtzman's question, doesn't the Constitution require impeachment?
Yeah. Again, I just think it's the issue of require. I don't dispute that the charge is serious enough. And what will be a very fascinating development is the next president, particularly if it's Senator Obama, will be in the position of deciding to what extent, as president, is he obliged to go back and revisit what happened in his predecessor's term to resolve some of these questions, find a way of bringing closure to them?
David Barron, professor of law at Harvard Law School. David, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Okay, and just ahead, former Congresswoman Elizabeth Holtzman, who asks, if the president led America to war based on false pretenses, should we just wring our hands about it? Does the Constitution require something more? That's in 1 minute, here and now. We're talking about the case for and against the impeachment of George W. Bush. We just heard from Harvard Law Professor David Barron, who says charges against President Bush don't reach the high bar required for such an action, and they're more about policy than anything else. Bush detractors point out that Bill Clinton was impeached for lying, not for his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, and they say Bush also dissembled in his push for war in Iraq. Well, let's turn to former New York Congresswoman and attorney Elizabeth Holtzman, who served on the House Judiciary Committee that recommended Richard Nixon be impeached and has long argued for impeachment of President Bush. She's written a book about it. Congressman Holtzman, so make your case.
Well, first of all, I think it's important to point out to your listeners that if Richard Nixon had not resigned, he would have certainly been impeached by the House of Representatives and would have been convicted and removed from office by the Senate. So while the bar is high and should be high because impeachment does involve removing a duly elected president, still, with regard to Richard Nixon, I don't think there's any serious question that he would have been impeached and removed from office and convicted by an overwhelming majority in the Senate.
But what we just heard from David Barron, though, is that the conviction would have come because of an ongoing criminal investigation, partisan wiretapping.
Well, the conviction would have come because the process was extremely fair and thorough, and because it was overwhelming evidence that the President of the United States had abused the powers of his office in a very grave and serious way. And there was a bipartisan vote in the House Judiciary Committee, but ultimately the vote became unanimous when a tape recording of the President's conduct and speech was released, and it was quite clear that President Nixon orchestrated the cover-up of the Watergate break-in.
Is there any is there any equal smoking gun in the President Bush administration?
Yes, absolutely. Although I think the professor makes a very important point that Congress has not done its oversight. I mean, in Watergate, you had the Senate committees, you had also had other committees that had investigated various aspects of Watergate. But with regard to this president, namely President Bush, not just the deceptions that caused us to enter the war, which is a subversion of the Constitution, but you also have deliberate and repeated violations of the statutes of the United States, some of which are criminal. You have the, for example, anti-torture statute. Now, I'm not saying that the president has in fact done that, but there are suggestions, and you can allege that the president has done it, violated the terms of the anti-torture statute. Then President Bush argues that he never violated that statute because we don't do torture, to quote the president. But the fact of the matter is that the Geneva Conventions, which are also the law of the land, prohibit the mistreatment of detainees in the way in which we've seen it happen. So you have a president of the United States who's put himself above treaties, put himself above criminal laws. I mean, at least you could make that charge, and it needs to be investigated. And you have a president who has said in over 700 statements that he's not going to obey laws that he himself signed into law. And with regard to the signing statements, the General Accountability Office examined the president's conduct and found that the president, in fact, did violate the laws. So you have a president who says, I'm above the law. And he said it with regard to FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, where he said, it doesn't matter that the law says that I can't wiretap without court approval. I'm going to do it because I'm commander in chief. Well, Nixon said that about wiretapping, and that was one of the grounds for his the House Judiciary Committee's vote for his impeachment.
Well, looking even further back, Howard Zinn, the historian, quotes Thomas Bailey, another historian who was sympathetic to FDR in the time of World War II. And Bailey writes that Roosevelt repeatedly deceived the American public. He was like the physician who must tell the patient lies for the patient's own good. There's history to presidents in times of war misleading the country. Johnson in the Gulf of Tonkin prior to Vietnam. Can the president say these were policy decisions? This was not an intent
to lie? I think you had to be very careful about attacking a president for policy. I completely agree with the professor. You can't say, well, I didn't like the Vietnam War, so I'm going to impeach President Nixon, or I don't like the Iraq War, so I'm going to impeach President Bush. But if a president undermines the constitutional system by lying to Congress and the American people, that could constitute a ground for impeachment. And the Senate and the House should have gone much further in terms of preliminary investigation into what the president knew, when he knew it, and why he made those misstatements to the American people. Beyond that, of course, aside from the war, I think it's very important to point out this is a president who deliberately violated the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act repeatedly, saying he was not bound by the law. And what is your check for a president who won't be bound by the law? Congress passed another law? Well, I'm not bound by that either. Impeachment becomes the only remedy when you have a president who says repeatedly and systematically, I am above the law.
That's Congressman Elizabeth Holtzman, who agrees with Dennis Kucinich that there are grounds for impeachment against President Bush. But, Congressman, just two last questions. Should Democrats take the energy away from the general campaign and put that energy into an impeachment? And, you know, doesn't the opposition to impeachment by leaders such as House Speaker Pelosi mean it isn't going anywhere? So why expend energy pushing it?
Well, I think you raise a very good question, and there isn't a lot of time. But if you do the impeachment process in the right way and you convince the American people about the constitutional standards, as we were able to do in the impeachment process against Richard Nixon, and if you do it in a bipartisan way and you do it in a fair way, I do believe that you will help to educate the American people about the boundaries of the Constitution and rein in future presidents, because this president is just setting the bar very low, and where will future presidents take us? And that's a big danger for our democracy, for people's liberties, and for the freedom that we hold so dear.
Attorney Elizabeth Holtzman, former congresswoman from New York. She served on the House Judiciary Committee during the push to impeach Richard Nixon. We also spoke earlier with David Barron, professor of law at Harvard Law School, who doesn't feel that impeachment is feasible at this time. Attorney Holtzman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, in Sierra Leone, there's one psychiatrist for the entire war-torn country. We'll hear from one American who's trying to change that. That's tomorrow. And still ahead today, where are we on singularity, the convergence of man and machine? They're calling it the rapture for computer geeks. That's after the news, Here and Now. Earlier this month, a U.S. military supercomputer called Roadrunner reached a milestone by processing more than 1 quadrillion calculations per second. How big is that? Well, if all 6 billion people on Earth used hand calculators and worked 24/7, it would take them 46 years to do what the Roadrunner did in one day. In computing terms, it was the equivalent of breaking the 4-minute mile, and some say another step along the path to singularity. Inventor, futurist Ray Kurzweil told us about that a while back.
Right now we can distinguish machines from humans, but that distinction is going to go away as we get to 2030. There won't be a clear distinction between non-biological intelligence and biological intelligence.
Well, since that conversation, the debate over when or if singularity will occur has gotten to the point that the Technology Insider magazine IEEE Spectrum devoted its entire June issue to the topic. John Horgan directs the Center for Science Writings at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. He wrote the magazine's lead article. So, John, a melding of humans and computers. Tell us more about singularity.
Well, first of all, I should say that a science fiction writer and computer scientist named Werner Vinge in 1993 used this term to describe a future event in which computers become smarter than us. They become conscious and smarter than humans, and then they're able to design even smarter versions of themselves. And then something happens, some kind of radical transformation in culture and society that really is beyond the boundaries of the imagination. That's what Vinge described. And now it's kind of a movement of people who really believe this is going to happen, not a millennia or centuries from now, but possibly within the next few decades.
Well, these are the singularitarians. They include Ray Kurzweil, of course, who says there's going to be immortal software-based humans. He's talked to us about how he, you know, feels he's going to live long enough so that this will happen for him. He will live forever. Then you have on the other side people like Steven Pinker of Harvard, who says, will singularity occur? Never, ever. But, you know, people who support it point to things like cochlear implants helping the deaf hear, and computer chips that are being experimented with to restore or augment brain memory. Where is research and science on those?
This gets us into the realm of what's called the neural code, which is the software that's thought to run on the hardware of the brain and underpins memory and perception and our understanding of language and all the things that make up a mind. So the problems of creating devices, electronic devices that interface with the brain, rely on solving the neural code in the future. And at this point, scientists have no idea how to do that. So the brain is this great unexplored frontier. This is really the most exciting area of science right now. The singularity is based on the premise that we'll really figure it out quite soon. But I think we're just beginning to understand it, and it really might take a century or more before we understand it enough to transfer that sort of intelligence to computers.
One of the other questions, it seems, within the debate is it depends on what you think consciousness is. The article quotes from Jeff Hawkins, who's the inventor of the Palm Pilot, who says, well, you know, if you think dogs are conscious, then you may think that some machines are conscious. If you think humans are the only ones who have consciousness, you won't. Of course, some of us who think that dogs are very, very conscious might be offended by that. But I guess what he's saying is that there will be a level of consciousness. Are some researchers distinguishing that way?
The problem with consciousness is, you know, it brings in all these ancient philosophical issues. I mean, no offense, Robin, but I can't even be sure that you're conscious. You can't be sure that I'm conscious. We're talking about subjective experiences which are private to each of us. I think the larger problem when you're talking about computers is common sense. So computers are very good at extremely well-defined tasks. What computers are really bad at is the kind of general problem solving that humans do every day just to get through the day. Computers can't, for example, come close to having the kind of conversation that we're having right now, which requires contextual knowledge. And computers are capable of performing all these different tasks, but you can't put those together into what constitutes a unified mind that resembles a human mind in any way.
Not whether or not I am conscious or not, but whether or not you might hurt my feelings by asking if I'm conscious or not. Machines are not there. You come to a really fascinating conclusion. You quote the science fiction writer Ken MacLeod, who's called Singularity, rapture for nerds. And in effect, it may just be not science but religion, sort of a yearning for an afterlife, the same yearning for an afterlife that devout people have.
Yeah, I think this is a really fascinating time in culture because there's this gigantic clash going on now between science and religion. So you've got scientists like Richard Dawkins and the philosopher Daniel Dennett who are ridiculing religious belief and saying that in a perfect world, religion would vanish and we'd all be ruled by science and rationality. But science, of course, gives rise itself to what are often irrational belief systems that I think are really best characterized as faith. And the singularity is a perfect example of that. So we're really talking about immortality, transcending the body, creating a kind of heaven on earth through science and technology. And, you know, these beliefs are based on some tremendous advances, especially in computers and information technologies, but they neglect all the areas where science is really bumping up against some limits. For example, treatments for cancer are still very primitive. Treatments for mental disorders like schizophrenia and manic depression are awful. There's still all sorts of side effects. So science is advancing in some ways, and I see that that's why some people hold out the hope that we can create a kind of heaven on earth, the singularity. But in many ways, science is failing to deliver on some of its promises.
That's John Horgan of the Center for Science Writings at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. He wrote about singularity in the current edition of IEEE Spectrum, the magazine for technology insiders. You can go to our website, here-now.org, to learn more. And we're going to revisit the singularity issue in early 2009 when Ray Kurzweil releases a motion picture. It's based on his book, The Singularity Is Near. And in the film, he downloads his consciousness into a bionic machine called Ramona, who goes into the future, becomes more and more human-like, hires a lawyer, Alan Dershowitz, playing himself, to press for her legal rights as a person. IEEE reminds us that we've seen this story before. Pinocchio was the wooden puppet who dreamt of being a real boy. Kurzweil, real boy, dreaming of being a computer. And we'll check in with him when that film comes out. And just a reminder, you can listen to today's show stream live at here-now.org. For past programs, click on the archives. You can always download a podcast. Take us with you, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Can music music help people with Alzheimer's? A new program in Phoenix, Arizona believes it can. The Arts Engagement Program at the Banner Alzheimer's Institute is bringing people with Alzheimer's to the symphony for the music and the social interaction. From KJZZ in Phoenix, Renee Gutel has our story.
Hundreds of people are taking their seats at Phoenix's Symphony Hall. A lunchtime concert's about to begin. On the second floor, a few dozen people are seated in pairs, listening to a pre-performance lecture by timpanist Bruce Polk.
This is a concert where the theme will be contrasts.
This private chat is for a group of Alzheimer's patients and their caretakers. They're here for the Arts Engagement Program, a series of concert trips designed to expose people with low to moderate Alzheimer's disease to the therapeutic effects of music. After the orchestra is tuned, the conductor strolls to the podium. Today's bill includes a Brahms symphony, followed by a lively violin concerto by Cacciatorian. Rosalie and Jerry Moore are in the audience.
This is our fourth concert.
The Moores have been married nearly 50 years. Rosalie Moore has early onset Alzheimer's. She says the monthly concerts have been a delight.
It's such good music that we really like it, and then we get our day together.
She's been very reluctant to get out and meet people and talk to people because she is concerned about not saying the right things, and this program has really helped her to emerge from that.
And that's just what the Banner's Alzheimer's Institute, along with the Maricopa Partnership for Arts and Culture, hope to accomplish here. Vicki McAllister is the program coordinator.
It's all about the opportunity to keep people engaged in the community and not isolated in their homes and with feelings of depression. And I definitely see a difference in all of these examples where there's a lot more fun, social engagement. They seem to be much happier.
Health experts say that memory for music is one of the last parts of the brain affected by degenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's. There have been many studies looking at the power of music therapy on Alzheimer's patients. The results are often mixed and success is limited. But the National Alzheimer's Association says music can enrich the lives of people with the disease. As the lights come back on, the audience strolls out, including Bill and Marion Bailey. Bill Bailey worked for 3M Company for 32 years as a national sales manager. Doctors diagnosed his Alzheimer's about 4 years ago. His wife, Marion Bailey, says her husband is always in a good mood after their outings.
Everybody always has positive things to say, you know, what each piece makes you feel like. You know, some of them are really exciting and some are kind of sad.
I think what Banner is doing is amazing and special.
The Baileys have recently begun attending more concerts on their own. Marion Bailey says the Arts Engagement Program has given her the confidence to get out more.
You know, one thing that really, today I was sitting there watching everybody, and we were with this group of people with caregivers and Alzheimer's patients, and we were no different than anybody else in the whole hall. You know, everybody was enjoying the music, and it's a good thing to have in anybody's life.
This program isn't meant to be a magic bullet that revives memory in Alzheimer's patients. The most obvious benefits appear to be social, the simple pleasure of enjoying music among friends. Jan Doherty is the director of Family and Community Services at the Banner Alzheimer's Institute.
Most of our participants today walked out going, wow, you know, just seeing it, hearing it, feeling it. It's kind of a multi-sensory experience, which is fabulous.
Alzheimer's affects 4 million Americans, including 500,000 people between the ages of 30 and 60. Doherty says the average age of the music program participants is 74. She says Banner and the Maricopa Partnership for Arts and Culture chose the Phoenix Symphony because of the convenient schedule of their midday concert series and because of the energy level of the live performance. A spokeswoman for the symphony says they've been happy to take part. The symphony donates the tickets and provides the timpanist for the private lecture. The Banner Alzheimer's Institute wrapped up the inaugural program last month. They're getting ready for a second round of concerts with a new set of patients and caregivers this fall. There's already a wait list.
Renee Gutel in Phoenix. For more on arts engagement programs, go to our website, here-now.org. And in 1 minute, a summer read got a little lighter just now. Back in a minute, here and now. If you're looking for a good summer read, Amy Bloom's epic novel Away comes out in paperback this week. When it was first published, Away was hailed by Janet Maslin of the New York Times as a literary triumph. It's the fictional story of Lillian Lieb, a seamstress in New York's Lower East Side in 1924, sleeping cheek to jowl with new immigrant friends like Judith in a tenement walk-up, trying to learn a new life even while the old is impossible to forget. A mother, father, husband killed in a pogrom back in Russia.
Lillian dreams of the murder of her family. She wakes to the sound of her own screaming and to another person's warm body. She eats bread and cabbage with strangers in a small, dirty room. She puts in and takes out stitches to make cheap hats, puts together blue petals and takes apart flawed silk flowers, and she does it all badly. She learns the language of a country that terrifies her so that she can dig deeper into it and make a safe hole for herself because she has no other home. She walks with Judith down Essex Street Saturday nights at 8 o'clock to watch the modern world, to move like an ox among the Americans.
But then a cousin arrives in New York with shattering news. Lillian's daughter Sophie, thought dead, is alive. And Lillian will travel across America and up the 300-mile frozen stretch of Alaska called the Telegraph Trail to try to get to Siberia to find her. We spoke to Amy Bloom, a descendant of Jewish-Russian immigrants, when Away was first published. She told us when she asked her grandma what the old village was like, her grandma said, "Not so nice. People didn't talk about what happened to them." So in her book, Amy tried to imagine it. We also asked about another reported inspiration for the book, the true story of a woman in 1927 named Lillian Alling.
Well, I think it's true a little bit. There have been some journalists who have tried to track the story of a woman, a Russian woman, who seemed to be intent on walking back to Russia, and that's really as far as anybody knew about her. The fact is, it was not undoable. There were a number of women who hiked the Telegraph Trail for sport, as well as out of necessity.
Right, and that's when your mind started taking off on its own story. Why do you have her going to find a child?
What I remember thinking is, what makes you take the big journey? And I thought to myself, well, what would make me do it? It would only be love, and it would probably be love of a child.
Yeah. In this case, the child, Sophie. Lillian had pushed out the window when this murderous pogrom starts. She was told that Sophie was seen floating in the river. She assumed she was dead. An unbelievable story to read about this murderous night in her home in Russia. She has recurring nightmares about seeing her mother's cut off hand. I mean, just horrifying. And the horrifying thought that she doesn't know really what's happened to her daughter. How hard was it for you to live with it?
Well, it was hard to live with, but I also think that in most of the world, things are hard. Terrible, frightening things happen to people, and they live with them, and if they're lucky, they survive them, and they often come to this country and just don't tell anybody any of what they saw in Liberia or Darfur or wherever they were however many years ago. Everybody understands that nobody really wants to hear how bad it was, and everybody wants to hear that you're fine. Mm-hmm. And that's what most people, most immigrants, and most survivors offer the world. So it was hard to live with, but it's certainly nothing compared to what people actually live with.
Mm-hmm. What kind of research did you do, research to find the characters that Lillian meets along the way on this incredible trip? There's the railroad porters willing to hide her in a cabinet on a train for maybe a little money or a little sex, the telegraph operators on this telegraph trail in the Northwest living in these little huts.
I did a lot of research on sort of the facts and the circumstances surrounding the characters. The characters were just a pleasure to make up and set forward into their lives. But, you know, I had read a number of books about the telegraph trail, about the kinds of people who became telegraph operators, and were either there for a year, and some of them there for 30 years.
This is how, you know, information was relayed in the early days. People living in these little huts.
It had a short burst of glory, which was really only about 25 years before radio completely took over. It was very, very necessary. I researched the telegraph operators and the telegraph trail. I certainly, you know, researched African-American life in Seattle in the 1920s. And also the idea that there were a number of families of con men and grifters for whom this is a multi-generational activity, whether they are gypsies or all-American con men or the Chinese grifters, and I liked the idea of this being a family business.
Right. And you also use a device, again, as Lillian meets these characters as she goes along, soon after they have some adventure, misadventure together, you then take a moment and write the end of their story. We have to wait till the very end to hear Lillian's, but a fellow female prisoner, Lillian serves some time, ends up, you tell us, running a respectable hardware store, a black prostitute who murders her pimp, converts and becomes a respected member of Hadassah. Why do you do that? Why do you take that moment to tell us what happens to them?
Well, because they are none of them minor characters to me. They are all big characters. They all deserve their own novels. And one of the things that I wanted the opportunity to do was to tell sort of a 19th century story in the sense of a big story, a big, dense story with a lot of wonderful characters in a different format where you could play around with time and location and where I could just sort of move through time like a river and send these little tributaries forward and then come back to the central story. And also, when I was a little kid, I loved 19th century fiction. I loved the idea of the epilogue, and I wanted to weave it into the novel rather than make it a postscript.
You know, in a way, too, it's sort of insight into a writer's head because, as we understand it, you often know that whole story, mm-hmm. even if you don't put it in the book.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And a lot of the backstory, you know, one is well advised to skip. You know, the reader doesn't need to hear all that throat clearing. But the idea of what happens next and that people have a future that exists off the page was always very appealing to me as a reader and therefore as a writer.
Yeah. A couple thoughts, and we are not giving away the ending for those who are reading this straight through as I did. You will never look at an elderly immigrant couple again the same way. If you did before, you will now think even more about what is the story. But also, again, we don't want to give away the ending, but if people wanted another ending, have you heard from readers? I mean, what?
I'm sure that the endings that people wish for reflect the endings that they wish for, which is perfectly understandable. This is the ending for the book that made sense to me. I am a great believer in love and even the possibility of romance, not so much in sentimentality.
Amy Bloom, the book is Away. By the way, Away, meaning?
A lot of what I find myself thinking about is that there are really only two stories in the world. I go on a journey, or a stranger comes to town. And either way, someone is coming from away and going away.
Yeah, Lillian is going to her daughter, but she's going away from her past, even as she's going to it in the form of her
right.
daughter.
Right. I mean, really the heart of this is when I was a little kid, I lived near an airport, and I would look at the signs that said arriving and departing, which threw me in a complete tailspin because I would think, well, surely if you are arriving, it meant that you were departing. And surely if you're departing, you would have had to have arrived first. That's sort of how I feel about away. No matter which way you are going, you're going away.
Author Amy Bloom, her book Away comes out in paperback this week.
What is it you say? Why did you pack up? Why did you run away? With fiery hope. You called and cut all your ties. Said you would head for the skies, at least as high as the mountains are high.